Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish. The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker Tov. Yeah, just a little update from a story that we spoke about last week. This relates to the protests of the resident doctors in Israeli hospitals who have been protesting and resigning against the requirement for them to work shifts of up to 26 hours at a time. So an agreement was finally reached with the Minister of Health, Nitzan Horowitz, and the agreement says that hours will be reduced over a period of time, and the hours will be reduced ultimately to shifts that will be no longer than 18 hours as opposed to 26 hours. And that will be implemented in various hospitals in Israel until between now and 2025. The new agreement will begin to come into force in March of next year. A number of hospitals, I think 10 hospitals, which are slightly removed from the central part of Israel, will be the first ones to implement the agreement, and then slowly but surely it will be rolled out to the remaining hospitals. Of course, one of the major issues is the shortage of doctors and medical staff in general in Israel's hospitals, and that's one of the reasons why these resident doctors have been required to work such long shifts. At least that's what we are being told. And it kind of relates to another story that I read recently about 3,000 Jewish doctors and health professionals who are waiting to make aliyah, and for whom the aliyah process apparently will be accelerated in order to try and bring them in and to allow them to integrate into Israel's medical health system as quickly as possible. Most of these people apparently come from the former Soviet Union, but they're also those who are waiting in the US, Canada, France, and Argentina, all of whom are interested in moving to Israel and ultimately integrating into the healthcare system. Of course, one of the pieces of red tape that is associated with healthcare professionals is this re-registration / re-qualification process. How do we somehow manage to maintain standards that we're accustomed to in Israel, making sure that people have been trained correctly and are up to the relevant standard required by Israel's system when people are coming from medical health systems abroad, which may or may not be up to the same standard. It kind of also ties into a very interesting conversation that I recently held with an ex-South African who made aliyah a year or two ago, a podiatrist, a person who'd been practicing in Johannesburg for more than 20 years as a podiatrist, was very frustrated when he was required to re-qualify coming to Israel. He was one of the first batch, apparently, of podiatrists who put into this program where they weren't allowed to register immediately, but had to go through some sort of a training process to re-qualify. And now, having almost completed that process, his view has changed completely. And he just said to me, it's a wow for him. He said the training that he's been through, the people that he's been exposed to, the new ideas that he's come across has been immensely valuable for him, and now, having been through the process, he's eternally grateful that he was forced to do that rather than just to be allowed to register as he had wanted to do when he first arrived. An interesting situation.
Fascinating. Really, really incredible to hear about. Let's take a look at some of the news stories. A revised bill for the enlistment of members of the ultra-Orthodox community has been submitted to the Knesset. What are the details of the latest bill?
Yeah, so this is just an internal, eternal thorn in the side of Israeli society in general. This issue that at the time of the founding of the state or thereabouts, David Ben-Gurion entered into an agreement with the ultra-Orthodox community at that point, that any of the young people coming through the yeshiva system and who would continue to study in yeshiva after reaching enlistment age would effectively be exempt from military training. In those days, the number of people who were exempted under this particular program was a relatively small number. Today, the numbers are incredibly large, much, much larger than before, much larger than could have been anticipated. And it has created a certain imbalance and lack of equality in Israeli societies where young people see the yeshiva students managing somehow to escape, as people view it, from the requirement to serve the country in any capacity. They simply are allowed to continue to study in the yeshiva, and everybody else is required to give some service to the state of Israel, whether it be military training or whether it be some sort of an alternative form of national service. So this has been, you know, this continues to be regarded as some sort of a lack of equality. And of course, tying into the amount of money that is invested by the government in the yeshiva program in order to give stipends to these students who are studying there, it even creates a greater level of concern. Now the new bill that has been submitted effectively reduces the annual targets of the number of ultra-Orthodox men who are required to enlist, actually beginning this year in 2021, and then slowly increasing over time. Whereas previously the target was set at around 4,000 to begin with, and then rising up steadily from there to 4,300 and more and more. Now the new target has been revised significantly downward to 2,100, and then for next year to 2,293, and then slowly increasing beyond that point. Now, one of the reasons we are told why the numbers have been downgraded significantly is because apparently the number of actual ultra-Orthodox people enlisting to the IDF was overstated to begin with. So whereas it seemed that reaching 4,000 and more would be a relatively easy exercise because of the number of people who are already enlisted, it now transpires that that number is a lot lower than everybody thought, or that at least some people were told, and so the numbers have been downgraded. There is another side to the story, and the other side to the story is whether the IDF really even wants to take on the responsibility of enlisting people who have such significant special needs and who potentially cost the IDF so much more to keep, and to have people who are potentially much less flexible in terms of what they're able to do once they serve in the army. And I mean, let's put things as plainly as we possibly can. The army is not going to be significantly strengthened by the addition of these 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people. There will be jobs found for them, and there are things for them to do, absolutely. But the army is not going to all of a sudden be massively strengthened by the addition of these people. This is really mostly about Israeli society rather than being about the strength of our military. Because actually, there are people in the military who say it's better for us just to give them a blanket exemption and not require them to come to the army, because the moment they come to the army, we have to accommodate them for special food arrangements. Even the kosher food in the army is not kosher enough for them, and we have to accommodate them with special uniforms because some of the things that the average soldier is required to wear is not okay for them, and we have to make sure that they have prayer times as specified according to the agreement, and they have to have time to study as well, and there's certain jobs that they may or may not be able to do because of certain contraventions that they are not willing to overcome. So there are a whole raft of limitations around accommodating these soldiers that the army, or at least some people in the army, would prefer not to have to undertake, not to have to take responsibility for. But this is really more about Israeli society and somehow creating an equality across all aspects of Israeli society. If one person is required to serve the country, all people should be required to serve the country by equal measure. And I think that this is really more of what this is all about.
Yeah. And you just wonder if there is a resolution to it. Is there a solution that everybody will be able to be equally as uncomfortable or equally comfortable with?
So, you know, again, the bill that's being introduced right now, I think, goes a long way towards somehow ensuring that there is a certain obligation upon the ultra-Orthodox community to serve Israel. They live here and benefit from the country, there is an obligation. And I think that this is really what the whole thing is about. The army, of course, will do what they are told by the political echelon. They will accommodate these people to the best of their ability. The army, in any event, is required to accommodate so many different strands of people. There's this huge program that the army has for disabled soldiers, people who, unfortunately, are not strong enough to serve in a combat unit or may not even be able to undertake an office job in the way that another person can, but who want to be part of Israeli society and who want to feel that they've served in the country. I came across a young man not so long ago who was very excited to tell me that he is going to the army. Now, he is a man who is disabled and won't be able to undertake a proper job, and the army will be required to fetch and carry him to home every day to make sure that he's safely delivered once he's done his job in the army. But they create roles for these soldiers, for these young people, because they feel that they want to be part of Israeli fabric, of Israeli society. They want to do their bit and serve the country, and that's, you know, they want to be like everybody else where that's concerned, and it's an immensely important thing for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Israel has granted 3,000 additional work permits to Gazans who wish to work in Israel. What lies behind this concession?
I love this little quiet activity that's going on in the background. We did discuss it, last week, Howard, and now it transpires not only that there have already been 7,000 work permits granted, but now a further 3,000 are being added so that there will be a total of 10,000 work permits granted for Gazans to come and work in Israel. I mean, on the one hand, Israel can really use the labor that will be generated by those people crossing, admittedly mostly in the southern part of Israel, and I'm expecting that most of them will be employed probably in the agricultural fields or in some of the factories that are located in the south. I think that that's a very, very positive thing for the local communities in southern Israel. I think it's massively positive for Gazans, because not only does it create some economy for them, most Gazans today live below the poverty line, and so this creates a little bit of economy and some income, and it also occupies people in a positive way. It creates work. You know, they say the devil makes work for idle hands, and to the extent that people are not being employed, they potentially are doing things which could be damaging. We've seen that in the past, and this is an opportunity not only to create good economy, but also to occupy people in a positive way, and it creates a certain relationship which changes the reality that we had experienced up until now. This conflict situation suddenly kind of is dissipated with people being allowed to go backwards and forwards, to communicate between each other, to see how people live, to hear what people think about, you know, what is going on along that particular boundary, and somehow to just generate a little bit more goodwill. And I think this is really amazing that we're able to do this. Of course, the work permits are predicated on the fact that there will be quiet. And this is a whole political issue rather than just getting people to work backwards and forwards. It's all predicated on the fact that there will be quiet, and that the Hamas regime in Gaza will continue to maintain a certain long-term truce situation without creating any conflict. Let's hope that that will last for a long period of time.
Yeah, this is just such a fantastic story. It also means money coming into Gaza, people having a little bit more disposable income, 3,000 people, and that hopefully will impact 3,000 families. I think that's just really, really incredibly positive, and hopefully will go a long way to, and the other thing is, you know, that Gaza is, the people in Gaza have been imprisoned really by Hamas. Here they'll be leaving the area, going to Israel, and maybe seeing a little bit of a different perspective once they're outside.
I think they will be allowed to hear another angle to the story, to this rhetoric. Because obviously in Gaza, they're only really hearing one side of the story constantly. And I think it's a very, very good thing. It's nice to hear the other side of the story. And hopefully that might impact on the way that people think and behave.
Absolutely. We've just got 1 minute left, just over. But Israel has signed an agreement with the UAE to cooperate on space exploration. This is an incredible story as well. What projects are
envisioned? Yeah, so this is just a rolling on of, you know, the relationship between Israel and the UAE. Israel has a massive pavilion at the expo which is a 6-month show that's going on at the moment in the UAE. And in addition to that, this agreement has been signed where there will be collaboration on space exploration. It will involve a number of different projects at the outset. The two countries will work together on database development and research from an Israeli friend satellite called Venus. And students from the UAE are going to work with Israeli students on a new satellite, which will apparently track the moon. But I think the big project, which this is really surrounding, is Bereshit 2. For those people who might recall, Bereshit 1 was the Israeli lunar module that was due to have landed on the moon and that unfortunately ultimately crash-landed on the moon, lost control in those final few moments just before the lunar module actually landed on the moon and so is on the moon, but unfortunately didn't quite do what it was supposed to do. And Maurice Kahn, the former South African and founder of Amdocs, who was one of the funders of that original project, has decided we're going to try again. This is going to be called Bereshit 2. And Israel will be building, hopefully, a lunar a module that will land safely on the moon this time around. And now with the new agreement, students and others from the UAE are going to become involved in Bereshit 2 in the hope that this time we will be able to land it on the moon the way it was designed to land on the moon without crash landing it as it was the previous time. So this is exciting not only for Israel that we've got this new project, but the fact that the UAE are going to be cooperating with us as well.